This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Hello. Oh, jeez. I'm dying. What I meant to say is hello and welcome to Dave Hill's podcasting incident with me, Dave Hill, the pride of Cleveland and beyond. I once got handed a ketchup packet from a stranger in Santa Fe in a bus station men's room. Looking back on it, that was weird. Anyway, thank you for joining me once again for Dave Hill's podcasting incident now, and it's, what is it, ninth exhilarating year, if you don't count the five-year break in between. I don't know if you can hear the breathing over in the corner. That's my sweet hellhound, Lucy, as always, making dog noises. And this episode has plenty of them. You'll be delighted to hear. Before I get into things, thank you to all of you who have been supporting us on Patreon. We really appreciate it. It helps us keep things up and running in slick fashion, as people have come to expect. If you would like to support this podcast or some of the other podcasting exploits we have cooked up for you, like Dave Hill History Fluffer, which we've just started releasing episodes, I encourage you to rate, review, and subscribe to that one and this one. What's going on with your throat, Dave? I don't know. Slowly dying. Aren't we all slowly dying, though, if you really think about it? Anyway, getting back to the Patreon, if you'd like to help us out and support incredible podcasting and help us keep this going, without your help, it gets so difficult. Patreon.com/Dave Hill. And if you can't do that, just do us a favor and go rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast or Dave Hill History Fluffer on iTunes, Stitcher. Gosh, the heat's coming on. Can you hear that? Wouldn't kill me to get a slicker operation going here. Your Patreon donations can help. See how I did that? Anyway, speaking of Patreon, and I'll shut up about it, I wanted to thank some of our new supporters. And you get all sorts of things. Patches, t-shirts. I'm going to call you and sing Billy Joel songs. Erotic short stories. I owe a few of those. And everyone who joins, so at the very least, you get to join my street gang, the Dangerous Snakes, who hate bullshit. Easily the most passive-aggressive and irritable street gang in existence. You get a street gang nickname. So I have a bunch of those to hand out today. I would like to thank Ryan Seavey. Ryan, you're dangerous. Well, you're irritable. And also Dangerous Snakes, who ate bullshit. Street gang name is Ryan Seavey, the Utah Strangler. And by strangler, I just mean he'll give you dirty looks at stoplights and stuff. Which isn't really strangling. But hopefully you see my point. And yes, everything I just said, that's your nickname. Deal with it. I'd also like to thank Evan McDowell. Evan, your Dangerous Snakes Who Hate Bullshit gang member nickname is On the Prowl, Evan McDowell. Chris, add some echo after I say McDowell. Cool. All right. Ben Parrott, thank you so much. Ben, your street gang nickname is Ben Parrott, Relentless Parking Lot Shopping Cart Lever. That's like, you know, if you go to your local grocery store and you take the cart. Well, you see my point. You get it. You're supposed to return the carts, ideally. Some people don't. Ben's among those people. He doesn't give a fuck. I'd also like to thank Christina Olson. Very generous Patreon contribution. Christina, your Dangerous Snakes Who Hate Bullshit game nickname is Christina Olson, the Mind Knitter. Chris, I hope you added some echo to that too. Christina is an incredible designer, and she knits some awesome stuff and comes up with her own designs, and it's beautiful, and you should seek it out if you like stuff that's awesome and also knit it. That's why I gave her the name the Mind Knitter, because she's, you know, knitting minds. Anyway, I'd also like to thank RJ Anderson. RJ, your Dangerous Snakes Who Hate Bullshit gang member nickname is RJ Anderson, careless thrower of lawn darts. And I know some of you are thinking, lawn darts, aren't those like banned? Aren't they illegal? RJ doesn't give a fuck. Just throws them anyway. Okay. Moving on. So much to discuss. I encourage you every Wednesday in April and May, I believe, with a couple exceptions here and there. We're going to be doing Dave Hill History Fluffer live shows. So come on out if you're in the New York area. They're lots of fun, and we hang out afterwards and have a couple cold ones. Good time is had by all. Also, May 23rd, the live, full live band debut of Witch Taint at Mercury Lounge in New York City. We'll be playing with Satanicide. It's going to be an extremely extreme night of extreme music. And hopefully you come and get your ass handed to you by Hot Rock. What else did I want to say? Lots of live dates coming up. Coming to you, London. Coming to the Greenbelt Festival in August in England. I think I'm coming to Budapest, Hungary, and Krakow, Poland. And the dates are shaping up. I'm going to try to get all over the world this year as much as I can. And, you know, probably get a few blank stares, but hopefully people will enjoy it too. Anyway, all those dates coming up soon on my incredible website, davehillonline.com. Let's get in to the heart of the matter, wherein I talk to a delightful person of note. Today, on Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, my guest is Mr. Frank Kniff, an amazing comedian, writer, raconteur, film buff, and, you know, so many more things. You know him from Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's just an amazing force, and he does all sorts of podcasts. We talk about all that. He's been on 78,000 TV shows, either in front of the camera or behind the scenes. He's a brilliant, wonderful, and delightful man, and our conversation went a little something like this. I was talking last night. I did a show with John Fugelsang last night, and he mentioned you were living right by here.
Yeah, I used to live on West 4th and Sheridan Square.
I can't believe, did we ever run into each other? Milling around the neighborhood? Were there mumbling
probably,
to myself?
Probably, I wouldn't remember it, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
That my first thought, of course, I was like, I wonder. I was probably picking my nose or something. Just walking down. Frank saw me picking my nose. I was in my tireless research.
Mm-hmm.
For this podcast. I didn't realize you... Well, you talked about, I was reading an interview with you where you were talking about playing in a band.
Uh-huh.
And I forget what the exact quote was, but you said something. They asked you if it was a garage band, and you said something like, that gives it too much elegance for what we were doing.
Okay. Yeah, I was in high school. I was in a band, Power Trio. Guitar, bass, and drums. I played the drums, and you know, we never really got any gigs or anything. We did like a couple of kegers, you know. I don't think we got paid, but.
And that that was here in New York.
Yeah, it was on Long Island, actually.
On Long Island.
Yeah.
Oh, so you grew up in Manhattan.
I grew up in Manhattan, and then I lived in Manhattan from like birth, although we were in New Rochelle for a little while, and then but I was in Manhattan, and then just as I was getting into my high school years, my father died, and my mom, whose family was from the Southampton area, she decided to get out of, she wanted to get out of the city, so we, for my high school years, I was a townie in Southampton.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where I had the band.
That's like the bad element.
Well, it's like, just I wasn't like, you know, one of the vacationers who goes there. There's, you know, there's in any town like that, which is basically a resort town.
Yeah.
There's the the you know, the vacationers who feed the economy, and then there's the people who are the economy, who serve, you know. And mm-hmm. I was, you know, I was just a year-rounder there, you know.
What was that like going from being in Manhattan as a kid to being way...
It was terrible. I hated it, actually. And you know what? Also, like in the fall and the winter, living out there, it's like 2 hours from New York. You might as well be in, you know, Alabama or something. You know, it's like, I think it's different now. I think many more people live there year round now. But it was just very bleak and desolate. I used to describe my teenage years there as a 4-year Ingmar Bergman film. It's just, you know, it was not fun. I didn't like the school I went to. There weren't a lot of, you know, a lot of people there who had similar interests. I basically dealt with it by starting my own stoner clique, basically, of friends. And, you know, we would get really high, and we played instruments, and we would listen to a lot of jazz, you know. And
you were like jazz cats on
well,
reefer.
I was a jazz cat on reefer, exactly. I was a jazz cat, and I kind of influenced the other kids to become, you know, to have them be into jazz too. I think if you, a lot of people don't like jazz, but if you get them high at just the right moment and play them, you know, play them some Miles Davis or something like that, then they can really hop on board.
Yeah, then it clicks.
Yeah.
Are you still into jazz?
I still am, yeah. It's always been my favorite music, although I think lately in the last several years I've moved a little bit more to pop. I started really getting into Laura Nyro about like 7 years ago or something like that, and that kind of, and you know, she was a great pop songwriter of the 60s and 70s, and then that kind of just reminded me, oh yeah, I really like Joni Mitchell too. And so, you know, I listen to a lot of that kind of stuff, and I listen to even more contemporary stuff now, like Kendrick Lamar and St. Vincent and Kimbra. But I'm basically a jazz guy, and basically I don't know a lot about what's really going on in the world in terms of music, but I'm very open to it, and I'm very willing to hear it, you know, when it comes to my attention.
Yeah, that's, I try to be that way, and then I find that like a lot of the new stuff, and I worry that it's that I'd like to think that it's not because I'm getting old, but I'll check in on stuff and I'm like, oh, I don't like that. I'm gonna run back to my
I have my comfort. Whatever. Yeah, the Kinks. We on the John Fugelsang show, we had Dave Davies on.
He was saying that last night. I did a show with him at mm-hmm. Symphony mm-hmm. Space. Oh my gosh, I would have had a seizure.
Yeah, he was very nice, and he was great. So I mean, I like all the baby boomer stuff, you know, Jimi Hendrix, and because that's my era. Everybody loves, I think their favorite music is always like from the era that they were a teenager and a young person in, you know.
Yeah.
And I, you know, but I'm very into all that stuff. But I, you know, listening to someone like Kendrick Lamar, or there's an artist, Kimbra, who's great, another band, Arc Iris, they're just young kids who, you know, a lot of them, it seems like they base their music on my record collection from 1974, you know, mm-hmm. So there's a lot of great stuff out there, and they're doing it all, you know, they're writing it all on computers now and stuff like that. It's a different thing, but talent is talent, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a weird thing, like with music also. Yeah, with the computers, like, mm-hmm. Just the lack of, like, I have a friend who has a 15-year-old kid, and he's like, well, because this is what I noticed last week. I was mm-hmm. playing, do you know Shanali Bhoumik?
I don't think so.
She's on the scene. Mm-hmm. She straddles comedy and music mm-hmm. worlds. But I was sitting in with her band on guitar, and then my own band was, we were playing a show together, mm-hmm. so I practiced two mm-hmm. nights in a row, two different bands, two different practice buildings. And both nights I realized, I was like, you guys, do you notice that there's no kids here? Like, there's no, like, 22-year-olds walking in here with guitars? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone's, like, our age. And they're like, oh, yeah. And then, so I called my friend, and And I was telling him this. He lives in Cleveland. He's like, yeah, I asked my son. He's 15. He's like, are there kids at school? Like, do you guys play in bands, garage bands and stuff?
Right.
And he's like, no, that's not, like, what we do.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole different thing, you know. It's a whole different technology, and you know. Yeah. But the brilliant people, you know, they figure they take those tools and they make great stuff with it.
Yeah, it evolves.
Yeah.
And also in my research, my tireless research, I love the story that you were in North Dakota when you got the call that you were going to be doing Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, that's true. I was at a club that called the Westward Ho in Grand Forks, North Dakota, that had a whole Western theme. It had wagon wheels on the wall. And
that's excellent.
They had a comedy night, as did every club in the 80s, had a comedy night. And it was part of a tour through North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and I was just sitting in the my hotel room at the Westward Ho, and Mike Nelson, who was a guy I had met, I ran an open mic in Minneapolis, and he came in and started doing it. You know, that's where I knew him from, and we became friends. And but now he was the head writer of Mystery Science Theater, and when J. Elvis Weinstein was on the show, but he left, and then there was an opening, and so Mike Nelson called and said, hey, I've recommended you for the gig, and everybody agrees, so we got picked up for another season by the Comedy Channel, and so come on. I don't even think there was a question of, do you want the gig? I think it was a given. I would take the gig. There was no, we're making you an offer, we hope you'll consider it. No, it was just like, this opening is here for you. And then it just went without saying that I was going to jump at it, you know, because I was just a middle stand-up comedy act in Minneapolis. You know, that was my whole career at that point.
Mm-hmm. And so you would have been in Minneapolis, like right in the middle, like when all the, a lot of great music. Well, there's always great music.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of great. Husker Du were there, and the Replacements, I believe, were from there. And,
yeah.
Prince.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
A little fellow named Prince.
He was there. And, I was one of the first person to ever give me a stand-up comedy gig that wasn't an open mic night. That was an actual weekend gig, and I emceed for her, was Liz Winstead.
Yeah.
She saw me. She was from Minneapolis, but she had moved away, but she was back in town. And she saw me at an open mic, and she said, hey, would you like to open for me this weekend? And that was like my first ever thing. And she was friends with all of those people. She, you know,
yeah.
She wasn't just aware of them. She was friendly with all of those guys.
Yeah, I think she's the one who,
and that's why Husker Du, the guy Bob Mould, or his name, he wrote the theme for the Daily Show.
Yeah I was gonna say, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I like how that stuff works out.
Yeah, so she was connected to all that, and I you know, I wasn't really I wish I had been, but I wasn't as into that scene. I think back then I was more of like the jazz guy that I was.
You're the
and
jazz.
I was kind of not, I was only listening to dead people. And
do you keep up with like contemporary jazz? Like, do you go to the Vanguard?
I don't go out to see stuff, and I wish I did, but you know, I think mainly I just still listen to all the people I've always listened to. You know, I think that's an area where I need to get out and see what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of your favorites
in jazz?
In jazz.
Oh, well, you know, Bill Evans. Bill Evans is my favorite jazz musician. But I also love John Coltrane and Miles Davis and, Ahmad Jamal, McCoy Tyner.
I saw Ahmad Jamal.
Oh, did you really?
In Chicago.
He's amazing. Yeah. I've never seen him live, and people aren't even aware of what a great innovator he was, and also a huge influence on Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a. Yeah, I feel like he's pretty underrated.
Yeah, yeah,
and so you and then so you went from there. You went. You were so you were in LA for.
Yeah, I did Mystery Science Theater for like 5 years, and that was just an incredible blessing to have that opportunity thrown at me while I was living in Minneapolis. And we did it in Minneapolis. And then after 5 years, I kind of wanted to go to L.A. and see what would it would be like to write another TV show. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. And what's your... You left L.A. Do you miss it?
You know what? I don't miss L.A., but I liked L.A. and I liked living there.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason I left was just for the small fact that I was completely washed up in show business. And John,
that's not, I don't believe that.
John Fugelsang called me, and he was given a show at the Current TV network, which was the liberal channel
that.
Al Gore had started.
Yeah, and I used to do stuff for them.
Yeah, yeah. And so that was like my first real offer for like a real regular job, and it was in New York. And I was, you know, I was excited to come back to New York, but I wasn't, it's not that I really wanted to leave L.A. It's, you know, I was actually, even though I wasn't, and when I say washed up in show business, I mean like I was, my profession was supposed to be TV comedy writer, you know, and I wasn't mm-hmm. getting hired for any shows anymore. So for like a couple years. And, but that was also a great period for me in L.A. too, though, because I was doing a lot of stuff that was just so much fun. I was a regular on the Jimmy Dore show every week on his podcast. I did the Young Turks. I was also wrote sketches and performed on the David Feldman show, which mm-hmm. which he was doing out there then. So on that show, like I was able to write and performing sketches with Martin Short and Paul Dooley and Robin Williams and Andrea Martin and plus all the great people who are my friends already, like Eddie Pepitone and Laura Keitlinger and all those people. And, you know, so I was just doing all this stuff that was just stuff I liked doing, and it was just fun, and it was just complete
yeah.
creative freedom. And I was actually, it was actually a wonderful period in my life out there. The one small hang up was that nobody was hiring me for a paying job. But other than that, and plus then that was when Joel Hodgson got the old Mystery Science Theater people together, and we started touring and doing Cinematic Titanic Live. That was mm-hmm. in that period, and that but that wasn't enough of an income to really make a living off of, because there were five of us. There were a lot of expenses
yeah.
to doing that as a touring show. But that was super fun too. So but then when Fugelsang called, you know, I just like was like, this is a job. I have to go make a steady income. And so I came to New York. And once I got back to New York, and I always loved it here, you know, and I'm from here. I grew up here. And now that I've been back, I just love being back. Like, and mm-hmm. so when the couple times I've gone out to L.A., I haven't felt when I've been out there, oh, I really want to come back here. Like, it's kind of now...
Yeah,
I've kind of got what I had in L.A. I kind of have in New York now, you know.
Yeah.
Except with more of an income and stuff. So so that's, you know, that's been great.
You said something interesting about, like, what you mean, like, you felt like you were washed up. Don't, mm-hmm. I always think, like, isn't show business or entertainment or the arts mm-hmm. or... I feel like it's a constant wave of... feeling washed up.
Yeah, I think that's how most people in the business feel. And people have various degrees of success. But I think there's kind of, you know, what you envision it to be when you start out, and then when you pursue it. And what I've been able to do is I've just been able to just kind of, accept what comes my way and, you know, pursue things and then see where it takes me. And then I just try to enjoy whatever it is that's going on, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, I'm not like a showrunner of a sitcom or, you know, or anything like that. But I'm doing, you know, all kinds of other things. And then I just enjoy them and hopefully and hope I don't get thrown out into the street.
Yeah,
at some point.
I think that's the key. Like, no. But that, because I've been thinking about this a lot. Well, especially this week, because I hit one of the, I was like so busy, and I was like, oh, yeah, I can't wait till I get a break. And then the second you get a break, I'm like, oh my God, it's over. It's all over. Mm-hmm. And then, but then you said something, what you were saying about it being that period of where, you know, you're really enjoying doing all this great stuff, which I think is always winds up being like what sort of gives more life to the work anyway. Is that
it does. If it, and for me, just being able to have creative freedom and write the things I want to write and then work with the people that I want to work with, you know, that's just such a blessing when that happens, you mm-hmm. know.
And you've been doing a lot of stuff out here at QED.
Yeah, at QED. Have the
Chris over here, the brains behind the operation.
Have the open riff night that I do there. And then also...
And that's tonight.
That's tonight.
Well, but
so those of you who are listening to this podcast,
if you're listening in the if you're breaking the times, but it's every second Wednesday,
yeah. And I still do a lot of stand up here in New York,
yeah.
And I did a lot of it in L.A. and I love doing that, and I love being part of one of the things that I think in terms of just realizing it not being what I was dreaming, but then it becoming something that I really appreciate, was just being able to be part of these comedy communities, you know, has been such a great thing.
Yeah.
Being part of the comedy community in Minneapolis when I started out, and being a part of the comedy community in L.A., and then here in New York, too. That I just treasure that so much. You know, that's such a big part of why it's fun to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of, I always say it's sort of like a better version of high school.
Yeah.
In a way.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
Someone was asking me last night after the, thank you, Lucy. It's guarding us. Mm-hmm. Make sure no one attacks the podcast.
All right.
The listeners are used to mm-hmm. a lot of interruptions.
They storm the building.
Yeah. But she interrupts with a lot of, you know, dog-based sounds. No, someone was asking, they came to the Symphony Space show last night, and they're like, oh, did you know? Because I did that. Have you ever done the Uptown Showdown show?
No.
Oh, you
no.
should do it.
I don't think I've ever done Symphony Space ever.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah.
They usually have a nice hummus.
Yeah.
Some salsa. It's my measure of a classy operation.
Yes.
They're like, so did you know the other people in the show? And I was like, yeah. That's sort of this. I was like, it's sort of like high school eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you'll meet new people, but eventually it's sort of like a lot of the same people. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so because you and John Fugelsang were doing a show for a long
time.
Yeah,
well, like I said, is that Fugelsang brought me to New York to do his current show.
Mm-hmm.
And... that ended when Al Gore, who we were hoping was going to create this liberal media empire, instead he sold the network to Al Jazeera. So that was the end of that. But even before that happened, though, then I got hired to work on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, which was a great experience. But that got canceled after like 13 weeks or something like that. And but then John got a show on Sirius XM, and he invited me to come in and just sidekick with him if I wanted to. I mean, it wasn't, when it first started, it wasn't even an actual gig. It was just, and I had nothing like really going on, you know. I was kind of out of work as a comedy writer, and so he invited me to. So for the first year, I just came in every day and was his sidekick, and it was really fun. And then they eventually started paying me, you know. But I did it for like 4 years, and it was really enjoyable. But then like a couple months ago, I guess I got in trouble because, you know, I'm very. I've developed a real kind of passionate disdain for corporate media in, mm-hmm. in the world we live in with Trump as president. There's a lot to be upset about. And the thing that I've kind of focused on is kind of how corporate media helped to make Donald Trump happen and help make the world that we live in happen. And so being just kind of the media freak that I am in the first place, like I obsess over how awful not just Fox News is, but CNN and a lot of MSNBC's programming, you know, how they gave Donald Trump unlimited access to their airwaves and just promoted him and promoted him. And then there's always all these awful people who were normalized by the media and treated as respected pundits. And that kind of came to a head for me when Chris Christie, who mostly I just try to do jokes about how fat he is, you know. That's mainly my specialty with Chris Christie. But it just pissed me off. He had a book out and he was promoting it. And he was coming on to Sirius. And he was just being treated respectfully, which I didn't like. And he even was on John's show, and I objected to that too. But what got me in trouble was that I wrote tweets criticizing Sirius for treating him like just a normal, respected pundit, and they didn't like that. And then I got shit canned.
It's bullshit.
It is, because what is bullshit about it is because I was on the show for 4 years, and I can say this confidently, that there was a general agreement among every aspect of everyone that I was great on the show. There was an agreement, among the listeners who paid to listen to the show, paid mm-hmm. subscribers. They all really liked me on the show. John liked me on the show. All the guests liked me on the show. It's very entertaining with just John there, you know, but it was more entertaining with me there.
Yeah.
I was genuinely an asset to the show, and then just abruptly Sirius said, fuck you, get out of here, you know.
What, dude? Because, but I feel like... Well, why would... Because especially Sirius, I feel like they'd have so much programming and so many viewpoints coming from all over. Why would they...
I think executives in that kind of corporate media world are very uptight, and they're very afraid of any kind of dissent. Dissent against them. They don't mind people having dissent against each other, you know.
Like, so you could be... If you could talk shit about... When I don't even know if it's still on, but they did the Breitbart show.
Yeah, and everybody, a lot of people who had shows like Pete Dominic and Dino Badala, they publicly objected when Andrew Breitbart was going to come back and be on that network. And then Steve Bannon.
Yeah.
The Roy Moore thing happened, and then he wasn't on anymore anyway, or whatever happened with that. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, they have a network there that's their conservative network. It's called the Patriot Channel, and that pisses me off that it's called the Patriot Channel, mm-hmm. and it's a cesspool. And I used to say that on the air, you know, it's a cesspool. It's Sean Hannity and Mark Levin and 3 hours of Breitbart radio every day. And to me, it's not a question of I'm on a liberal side, you're on the conservative side. It's like, I'm on the liberal side, and you're on the side of racism and anti-Semitism and hating brown people. And I don't consider it like just, oh, let's just have a respectful disagreement over that you're on this, you're a conservative, you're over here, I'm a liberal, I'm over here. To me, like now, in the world we live in now, it isn't that anymore at all, at least to me.
It's not at all. And it's also... having to even consider these ideas, which I like this whole, you know, I'm in a fight on Twitter every couple of days at least, but or someone mm-hmm. just reacting to something I said or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like this whole, like, you know, like, oh, the intolerant left,
yes.
or whatever. Like, you're supposed, tolerance has nothing to do with tolerating hate.
Yes,
like
this right,
new
right.
idea you're supposed to be like, I'm tolerant. So
yeah.
If you, I respect your Nazi viewpoint. Right.
Yes, exactly. That's my big issue is that the mainstream media, the corporate media, they've normalized that. They've taken that point of view and they've normalized it, and they present it as just the other point of view. They have to see both. Every issue has to have both sides, you know.
But how did that become? I still can't wrap my head around how that's become a side, like a point, like this is a point of view.
Yeah.
Like, and we're gonna listen to these fuckers.
I know.
You know, I was speaking to a relative, and they are conservative, and they were saying like, what do you think about and I was like, but don't you understand, like you're talking about like full on racists, like there's literal Nazis marching in the streets because of this current president.
Yeah, it's
like,
not that they're for trickle down economics and I'm for more government intervention. Yeah. It's not a divide like that, you know.
Yeah, like and I reminded him, I was like, do you remember when it was just like when it was more like that? I was talking about Deep Purple, or you know, like I wasn't fucking talking about this.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I was just talking about rock bands, and you know, and I said to him, I said, like, you know, things have to be really fucked up if I'm like in a point of like daily engagement on all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like I was probably more engaged than I realized.
Right. And it's weird now, you know. Like every comedian or everybody's Twitter feed is political now. Like it used to, like a few years ago, like I did kind of a lot of political stuff on Twitter, and sometimes some of my fans from Mystery Science Theater would object to it. But now it doesn't stand out anymore now because everybody's Twitter feed is political these days.
Yeah, and
it's like, how can you not be, you know?
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, I mean, like when I perform on stage, it's not, I don't think, you know, by the time showtime, when it gets to be night and it's time to do a show, I'm like, I'm just exhausted from politics. So like, I don't really talk about it on stage, but all day, you know.
I know. I'm the same way. I talk about it much more on Twitter than I do in my stand-up act. I talk about it a little bit in my stand-up act. But.
Well, it's like, do you have that feeling like of, by the time it's 8, 9, 10 o'clock, I'm like, I just want to tell dick jokes.
Yeah,
or whatever it is.
And it's also, I think it's a really, you know, it's great to just escape from it for, not just for you, but for the audience to just be able to go out and just laugh at something.
Yeah,
and just not have to have all that heavily weighted on them all the time because it's there all day.
Yeah, yeah. It's like there would be no relief if all the shows were that as well. But I don't know, do you anticipate, like, someone was asking me this last night, they're like, when do you think we'll go back to, like, a friend from Australia, well, actually, that was my sister's friend who's visiting, I'm like, what do you think will happen with him? I'm like, I don't know if I'll be alive by the time things go back to any sort of...
That's civil, there's no normal. Telling at this point, and there are reasons to hope. There are great, you know, the midterms were very encouraging, but there's no guarantee that it's all going to turn out fine, you know, so we just have to keep working towards making it better. But
yeah, absolutely.
But it's very, very bleak the way it is now, and it gets worse every day. The stage that we're in now is still it keeps getting worse stage.
Well, this stage of like where people are, there's huge factions of people who are just like dismissing, you know, every credible, you know, what is generally considered to be credible news source.
They're yes.
Like what you and I might think of Fox News. There's a bunch of people that will say that about the New York Times.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Hopefully. But I sort of liken it to, maybe this is not the right analogy, but like if you had a septic tank, mm-hmm. and it just exploded, and there was shit everywhere. And you were just like, oh my God, there's my beautiful backyard is covered yeah. in shit.
Right.
It's like, well, no, the shit was always there.
Yeah.
We just got to clean up the shit and get a new septic tank. That, I don't know if that analogy makes any sense.
I think that makes perfect sense.
But now I feel like there's shit everywhere, but I'm still not. I feel like maybe we can get it cleaned up.
I hope so. There's hope. I'm not saying there's no hope. I'm saying that before the next barbecue, hopefully we can make it happen.
I don't know. Yeah. Why? How did we go down this this wormhole? Mm-hmm. But you also I love that you do a few shows. You enjoy talking about movies, often bad movies.
Yeah, I like talking about good movies too.
Yeah, you know. Well, you've got both ends covered.
Yeah, I've always been a film buff, and actually the podcast that I do called Movie Sign with the Mads, which is me and Trace mm-hmm. Blue, also from Mystery Science Theater, and then Carolina Hidalgo, our friend, or Chris and I's friend, who's a comedian. We do a weekly podcast, and the format is just we pick a different movie every week and just talk about it. And most of the time, it's positive. Most of the time, we talk about movies that we like. You know, every now mm-hmm. and then, we'll get into something bad. But people, because of my association with the show, people don't even think that I like good movies. You
know? They're like, here's a really bad movie you should watch.
And people also always ask me, and we do a Q&A at all our shows, they always ask, you know, are you capable of going to a movie and not doing commentary on it? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Anytime I go to a movie theater, even if it's a bad movie, if I'm there with a paying audience, I'm quiet, as everyone should be when they go to a movie.
Didn't you got upset at Greta Gerwig because apparently she was talking during that Amy Schumer movie, I think?
Oh, well there was I think someone did a whole tweet storm about that Greta Gerwig, but the person who did the tweet thing about it, people pointed out that you were being really disruptive.
She was on her phone the whole time, yeah.
Yeah, so,
where is this scenario where Greta Gerwig...
Apparently someone was live tweeting Greta Gerwig sitting in a movie theater talking throughout an entire movie.
But you were not viral. There.
No, I wasn't there. This was something that was... Another like 6-hour Twitter sensation.
Oh, okay. Wait, so she was seeing an Amy Schumer movie?
I think it was.
I Feel Pretty.
The one. Oh, the one with
that came out about a year ago.
What? And she didn't like it, or she did like it?
She didn't like it.
Now I'm starting this whole thing over.
She was, I guess, like talking throughout the entire thing, and someone was live tweeting it, and a lot of people got upset.
And I think the person that I think what happened too was the person who was live tweeting it. Then did a very big defense of talking during a movie and texting during a movie, and she was saying, well, that's why people don't go to movies, is because they're not allowed to text and just relax and talk with each other, and people should be allowed to do that. And that I remember that as being the thing that I think I tweeted to her about that, you know.
You're like, when I go to a movie, I know to just shut up.
Well, this is again. I guess it's because growing up in a different... I remember, like, you would never take out, like, a camera.
Well, no one had them back then.
If you had, like, even, like, a disposable camera, like, it would be insane to do that.
Yeah.
Like, it would just be like, what is this? And now you can't really go to a show without people...
Well, it depends on where you go, because Trace and I, we do shows all over the country. This weekend in Omaha at the Alamo Drafthouse chain, and they're like really hardcore about if you text or talk during a movie, we'll give you one warning and then we'll throw you out, no refund, you know.
I like that.
Yeah, they're very hardcore about it, and it's great. And that's why in New York, there's an Alamo in Brooklyn that when I want to see a movie, I try to go there, you know. Mm-hmm.
They bring the hammer down.
Yeah, they do. They're very into creating a really good movie-watching experience.
Well, because it just seems like Yeah, like when you see the glow go up on something,
yeah,
it's super distracting. But
it's
distracting. I even find being home, like watching movies, like because of this constant, like we have everything. Do you find that you can watch movies at home, or do you?
No, I do. I watch stuff at home a lot. In fact, last night on Amazon Prime, Stanley Kubrick's very first film, Fear and Desire from 1952, I watched that. Really interesting to see someone who became like the world's greatest filmmaker at the early stage when he didn't even quite know what he was doing. It's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I do watch movies at home, and the main difference, and I do concentrate, I always turn the lights off. If it's something that I'm really into, you know, I turn the lights off and mm-hmm. I watch it. But the main difference is that when I need to pee, which is quite frequently, I pause it up. So maybe the impact of some movies might be diminished a little bit by the fact that sometimes I'll pause it up three times. Well, you know, in the
course of the
movie.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
But like now we have these things like with TV shows where they're like the second screen experience, like you're supposed to be like on your iPad while you're watching the show. Uh-huh. And doing like some bonus content throughout, and now so. But I'm
I don't do that. I don't have, and I'm very into like when I watch a movie, like if I'm watching it with someone else in my house, like I don't. It annoys me if they make comments about it to me, or they start talking. Like I just want to concentrate on the movie.
Yeah,
you know.
I get really upset with myself when I'm watching a movie at home and I start to like check other things and stuff. Like
I'll check my phone notifications and stuff, like, you know, but stuff like that.
Well, I just signed up for the Criterion channel.
Yeah, same here.
And my girlfriend was like, you're not gonna watch those, like you always do that. And then I'm like, I'll show you. So because it's like Hulu used to have like so many of those movies,
right?
And like they even had like a ton of like Kurosawa movies, so I'm like, I want to watch a Kurosawa movie. Mm-hmm. But then it was getting late. I was like, what's one that's not like 9 hours long? And then the first one is it's only like 1 hour and 20. I'm like, I'm gonna watch that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was out of it. I was lost in like 20 minutes, and I was like berating myself.
Yeah. Well, one thing that happens to me is I'll watch movies late at night, and then I'll get drowsy, and then sometimes I miss two scenes because I dozed off. Even if, and it's no reflection on the movie. It's just because I'm watching when I'm really tired. And then sometimes I'll just watch that amount and then watch the rest the next night or something. But I really try not to do that. I really don't. For a single movie, I would rather not do that. But I have done that on occasion.
Where I
save it. I'll watch the rest tomorrow night.
Yeah.
You know.
I
kind of feel with a movie, it's part of the experience to watch it from beginning to end.
Yeah, it's
in one
meant
sitting.
To.
Yeah.
But I get so frustrated when I get... Yeah, late at night, get lost. Like, mm-hmm. especially like, a foreign film or something.
Yeah.
Like, when you're like, why is that person just staring angrily? I dozed off. I don't know why.
Yeah. Also,
why did that samurai just storm out?
Mm-hmm.
No idea.
Also, when I read late at night, it can make me very drowsy, which I hate. I kind of have the opposite of insomnia. Like, I kind of want to stay up later. So like if I'm reading a book that I'm into, like I want to stay up and keep reading it, but then I'll get really tired and I'll go to sleep. But I think with a foreign film, part of it is it requires reading, you know, and that adds to making me tired, is having to read the subtitles.
It can be some work.
Yeah.
Just gotta keep plugging away.
Yeah,
that's why I have another 20 minutes left in this Sanshiro Sugata.
Oh, okay.
Which I'm completely lost on. So no idea. And so, well, we should. Let's. So every second Wednesday
mm-hmm.
is
Open
at
Rift
QED.
Night. It's at 7:30. Starting next month, it's at 9 p.m.
We're switching with History Fluffer.
Oh.
It's going to be back-to-back.
Back-to-back. Back-to-back heat. That'll be perfect. Mm-hmm. That actually works out really well for me, because then I can do...
Oh, then you'll do your show earlier then? Is that how that's working?
Yeah, so History Fluff will be 7:30 and then...
Have a lovely night at QED Astoria.
Yeah, as is any night at QED Astoria.
It really is. It's a lovely night. Not to give that place a commercial. I don't want to give it any extra publicity, but what a delightful
space. It's so great.
Space.
It's my favorite space in New York.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Frank will also be at Movies Are Dumb, which is their... when we show a full-length movie and have comics riff over.
And that's Friday night.
Friday, April 19th is the next one.
Excellent.
With Howard the Duck.
Classic.
Which I've never seen.
Cleveland Connection.
I'm always amazed by the movies he hasn't seen. Like The Room he had never seen.
Have you seen it now?
I have. I saw it when I riffed it at QED. And, you know, people, because of my association with bad movies... people always come up and talk to me about The Room. People give me Room merchandise. Like, someone gave me a comic book based on The Room. And the thing is I really fucking hate it. I mean, it is hilariously awful, and it's I can see why everybody does riffs on it, because it's perfect. It's so bad. But I don't have the affection for The Room that I have for, say, Plan 9 from Outer Space, or Glenn or Glenda, or any of the number of the movies that I've riffed many times. And like those older films, there's kind of an innocence to them. Like, I have affection for them. They're bad, but I like them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And The Room is just misogynistic trash, you know? I mean, I'm really happy to never see The Room again. And I'm sure I'm going to be forced, probably by Chris, to watch it again at some point. Yeah.
Well, The Room, like, the weird thing, and I don't know how, I mean, I guess many people arguably have had this experience, but I weirdly met Tommy Wiseau before I had any idea, I'd even heard of The Room. So my first experience was meeting this weird guy.
Right.
And not understanding. I have no idea what's going on. Or why he asked him where he was from.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, what? It's just a Comic-Con, this guy happened to be talking to.
Right.
And I'm like, what? And then shortly afterwards, I was in London. I went to a screening of The Room. And I had the same thought. Like, I was just like, oh, this is horrible. But it's all, like, I felt such pain for the people who had to make it. I was like, oh, my God, these people had to show up day after day and do this.
Right.
They had to show, some guy had to show up and be the cameraman on this movie. And then I saw it again.
That's the problem with The Room. Well, people see it more than
sneaks,
once.
I went to a screening on it, and then I was at someone's house, and then they were like, let's watch The Room.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have the confidence. I didn't know the people well enough to feel good about leaving.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't... my gut was like, get out now. Go. But instead, I watched it again. And I just went through the whole thing in my head again of just like... And I actually read that book,
The Disaster Artist.
And I ended up being like, now I understand why... Of course, why these people do these movies, because people need to work, and also people are like, well...
But the movie that they made from that book, which was an entertaining movie with the James Franco thing, but before I see it, people said to me, "Yeah, it's funny, but it's kind of an inspiring story about believing in yourself." I'm like, "What? You know, it's an inspiring story about a guy who had access to $6 million and then made this shitty movie." You know, that part. I didn't get that kind of... that some people found it uplifting in that way, you know. To me, it was like, you know, no, you know, you, that was like a waste of $6 million. It's not an inspiring story that you had all this money and then you made a crappy
movie. Yeah, no, I don't think, it's not like stick with your dreams.
Yeah, that's, it's like not that weird kind of story at all. Whereas actually, though, the Tim Burton movie Ed Wood is that story. And, mm-hmm. and Ed Wood is, to me, and I love Ed Wood and I love his movies. And Ed Wood, to me, is an inspiring story of an independent outsider filmmaker who just, against all odds, you know, made a bunch of films. And, you know, he had many competency issues, you know, but his films are beautiful in their own way, and I love them.
What do you think about, you know, there's, I mean, I guess it's been going on for some time, but like movies that are like, they make them with the idea of sort of becoming
like Sharknado.
Yeah, Shark. And I've publicly railed against that. I don't. It's not what I'm into at all. To me, and I've always said, like, people ask me, like, what's the best kind of film to do for Mystery Science Theater? And I'm always saying that the bad films that we do, the key element to them is sincerity.
Yeah.
Sincerity on the part of the filmmaker. All of the films that we did were made by people who were really trying to make films that would give them good careers and that would, you know, that would be entertaining in whatever way, and they fell short of that. But it's the sincerity that makes it riffable to me. But when the filmmaker is already in on the joke in the first place, like, it, I have no interest in that one ever. And the Sharknado films, I haven't watched any of them, and I'm just not interested, you know.
The only one of those movies that, have you seen The Greasy Strangler?
No, I've never heard of that.
Have you seen it?
Never.
Okay, no. That's my suggestion.
Okay.
And it's not a defense of that. I just, when you watch it, you're like, because who is the guy? Who's the Lord of the Rings kid? The
Elijah Wood or something.
Yeah,
like that.
He's the executive producer.
Oh, really?
So you're like, well, you know, this is like not, these mm-hmm. guys aren't like outside. But then this movie's just,
but is
so,
is it a comedy though? That
it's like
sounds,
a dark
it
comedy.
Sounds like a, well, that's a different thing though to me.
Yeah.
Like making a dark comedy.
I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, and that, and I'm sure it worked on that level. But if it's, but was there any vibe from it of like the filmmakers were making a shitty movie on purpose and you're going to laugh because this is so bad, but we're in on the joke? That's a different thing than just making a comedy that might be campy or might, you know, might have those kind of B-movie elements to them, but you're making a movie that's supposed to be funny and supposed to be, mm-hmm. you know.
I'll be kidding. We'll have to have you back, and we'll do a special Greasy Strangler episode. Because this movie,
I love the title.
Well, was it? Some friends recommended it, and I was just like, no. And then somehow it kept coming up. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, I'm going to watch mm-hmm. this. And then I was like, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. I'm all about it. well, let's drive it home. And thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Yeah, appreciate it.
There you have it, my delightful conversation with Mr. Frank Kniff. If you're in the New York area, he's performing all the time. He's doing a lot of stuff out at QED, Astoria, where I've been doing a lot of stuff myself. So seek him out. He's amazing. And just, once you go down the rabbit hole, you'll there's so much. It's a whole empire. Anyway, thank you, Frank, for joining me today. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in wherever you are on planet Earth or beyond. Chris, add echo after I said beyond. Once again, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. And also Dave Hill, History Fluffer, which you also don't want to miss. And I really, you know know I beg all the time for you to rate, review, and subscribe, but that's the way you get on the hot charts there on you know, the various podcasting services like iTunes, Stitcher, and all that. And then other people find out about the podcast. And next thing you know, you're like a podcasting czar, which is the goal, of course. You know, I don't want to get back to turning tricks. I'm just kidding. I never turn tricks, but, you know. Anyway, I don't know why I said that. Let's get out of here. Thank you to my partner in crime, Mr. Chris Gersbeck, the brains behind the operation. And once again, I encourage / beg you to support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/Dave Hill. Throw a little money in the till and hopper, and we can keep these hot podcasts growing and coming at you. And you know, hopefully bring some light into your life. I know it brings light into my life doing this, so there's that too. Let's not rule it out. I guess, Chris, maybe add some explosions right about here, and we'll go out on like a, you know, powerful, epic note. I don't know, like a or whatever. It's up to you, really. Okay, I had a nice time. I hope you did too. I'll see you next week, and we'll see you over on that Dave Hill History Fluffer podcast, which I was talking to a friend today, and she was like, that's the greatest podcast of all time. Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, pretty great. Dave Hill History Fluffer, groundbreaking, incredible. That's just what she said, but I don't know. Why don't you listen and find out for yourself? Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.